where the Communities Organizing for Unified Power has announced its latest effort to register and mobilize Indigenous voters through the HESOPA Voters Project. Natalie Stites-Means is the COOP Executive Director.
We're a nonpartisan group. We don't work with either political party. We are solely interested in more Native Americans registering to vote. We feel like Native Americans are the future of South Dakota. We're the majority minority. And it's been demonstrated that our voting rights are definitely inhibited by the conditions that we're facing here.
Advocates say conditions like long drives to polling locations, few if any satellite polling locations, and a lack of public transit options on reservations contributes to an already well-established weariness of government on reservations. Stites-Means says it's not all about Washington, D.C., though.
What we're really interested in is our local, state, city, municipal elections. We have seen really small margins put people in office, and we want to help galvanize our community to care about these civic issues and public policy issues that are creating these conditions where we are disenfranchised and disempowered.
For Stites-Means, that means taking a hard look at economic development in reservation country.
In South Dakota, half of us live at or below the federal poverty rate. In contrast, the white population, at least in 2020, only 8% of them lived below the federal poverty rate. Voting is a social determinant of health.
The Get Out the Vote effort will continue through the election. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 19th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes May Carrere, Eric Tagadoff, and Roz Brown. The producers Annette Newell and our engineers Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you would like to become a member or support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. In U.S.-China relations, climate change talks could be the last, and trade barriers rise. More war and no peace in Ukraine. And the horrific state of women's rights under the Taliban. First, in U.S.-China relations, climate change talks could be the last, and trade barriers rise. While the House of Representatives was busy passing bills that target China, I listed these in my Tuesday commentary on KBOO. John Podesta, President Biden's climate change advisor, and Liu Jianmin, China's counterpart, met in Beijing in what could be the last chance to strengthen their joint commitment to fighting global warming. The best case scenario is that Podesta and Liu agree on potential climate targets ahead of the United Nations COP29 International Climate Conference in November, days after the presidential election on November 5. Podesta told Foreign Minister Wang Yi that despite bilateral tensions, we can find places to collaborate for the good of our people and of our climate. Wang called U.S.-China climate talks an integral part of bilateral relations. But the ability of the U.S. to deliver on climate targets hinges on Vice President Kamala Harris, who is likely to maintain Biden's climate policy settings, winning the election. If Harris wins, Biden may have a shot at pushing Chinese leader Xi Jinping toward a more ambitious climate agenda with the U.S. in likely face-to-face meetings at both the APEC, that's the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Peru, that opens November 10, and the Group of 20 meeting in Brazil that convenes 8 days later. Climate could become a U.S.-China diplomatic ice-breaking issue even before Harris takes office, said Minister Li. U.S.-China trade, on the other hand, continues to move in the opposite direction. U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports have risen dramatically. Kamala Harris accepts the idea that those tariffs will hurt U.S. consumers, but she hasn't backed away from the high tariffs on Chinese goods that Trump started and Biden has continued. Eric Zheng, president of the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, says, quote, applying higher tariffs would not be in the best interests of either country. Next, more war and no peace in Ukraine. Russia expelled 6 British diplomats with the explanation that the decision had been made in response to, quote, the numerous unfriendly steps taken by London. The expulsion continues a tit-for-tat diplomatic war that started in May. This time, Russia's action is probably in response to signals from Britain that it will allow Ukraine to use its Storm Shadow long-range missiles against military targets deep inside Russia. Speaking about that potential shift on the use of missiles, President Vladimir Putin warned that such a decision would mean that NATO countries were, quote, at war with Russia, and that it would, quote, clearly change the very essence, the very nature of the conflict, unquote. Of course, NATO really is already at war with Russia, and the very essence of the conflict is that Russia has put no limits on the conventional weapons used to destroy Ukraine. The United States has put limits on Ukraine's use of American weapons against military targets deep inside Russia. But those limits have been eroding as President Biden over the last few years has allowed Ukraine to attack Russian targets in border areas. Now he reportedly is ready to lift those limits altogether in coordination with Britain's permission for Ukraine to deploy those Storm Shadow missiles. The two leaders met recently in Washington but made no announcement of a policy change. It's quite possible that permission will be granted to Ukraine without an advance announcement. Meantime, Russian forces continue their advance in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine, posing a serious threat to a major city there, Pokrovsk. When you look at a map of the current military situation, you see multiple arrows indicating the forward movement of Russian forces and the possible encirclement of Ukrainian units. Those missiles that Ukraine wants will not help them to hold on to territory. The horrific state of women's rights under the Taliban. When the Taliban took over Afghanistan in 2021, its rulers, hoping for economic aid from the West, promised that it would revise its severe limits on women's rights. Only the naive should have believed the Taliban's leaders, and now those leaders have made clear just how far they will go to restrict women's movements, opportunities, and speech. Its Ministry for the Propagation of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice, which had previously issued edicts restricting women's employment and movement, last month published further vice prevention laws. Besides mandating that women must be veiled at all times in public, the new law also states that clothing should not be thin, tight, or short. Women should veil themselves in front of all male strangers, including Muslims, and in front of all non-Muslims to avoid being corrupted. A woman's voice is deemed intimate, and so should not be heard singing, reciting, or reading aloud in public. It is forbidden for women to look at men they are not related to by blood or marriage, and vice versa. Women are not allowed to be transported if alone. The dire situation of women in Afghanistan, as well as in Myanmar and Gaza, is the subject of international discussion of a new convention to ban gender apartheid, defined as the institutionalized, systematic subjugation of one gender. Gender apartheid would be a crime against humanity in the proposed treaty. In other news, China's economic growth may have peaked. Nothing in economic development is certain, but China's economy has probably already peaked in size as a proportion of the global economy, reaching that peak in 2021. China now faces an economic slowdown as the financial system constrains economic growth rather than facilitating it. These economic pressures are directly linked to the end of an unprecedented credit and investment expansion during the previous decade. The resulting credit crunch has produced a collapse in property investment and slower local government infrastructure investment. Bloomberg reports that, quote, figures released September 14 show Chinese factory output, consumption, and investment all slowed more than forecast for August, while the jobless rate unexpectedly rose to a six-month high. The stock market is wobbling. Moreover, GDP growth has almost certainly been overstated in the official data both in 2022 and 2023. The notion of peaking is controversial. One measure is the place of China's economy in the world economy. By that measure, China's economy rising from 3.6% of global GDP in 2000 to 18.3% in 2021, and then dropping to 16.9% of global GDP in 2023. The U.S. economy has averaged around 26.2% of the world economy during all those years. What makes China's slower growth structural, not cyclical in nature, is a declining workforce population, credit and investment drop-offs, failures in real estate and infrastructure, and the flight of multinational corporations to more accommodating locations. All these problems suggest the need for significant reforms, but there is no sign that the leadership accepts the idea of peaking and is prepared to put major funds into propping up the weak sectors. Its priority seems to be major investments in those high-tech areas that compete with the West, namely electric vehicles, renewable energy, and semiconductors. Many observers see China's economy as being in the doldrums. A Wall Street Journal writer, for example, reports, quote, without more forceful stimulus directed toward boosting spending instead of expanding supply, the risk, economists say, is that China slips into a damaging period of falling prices and subdued growth similar to Japan's decades-long stagnation or the painful debt workouts that followed past real estate crises in Europe and the U.S. The only bright spot for China these days is exports, but even that bright spot has problems, chief among them being resistance to Chinese electric vehicles in Europe and major tariff increases on Chinese products in the U.S. and India. Regarding those EVs, the European Union is investigating China's aggressive marketing. It has to decide by late September whether or not to continue EU tariffs on those EVs. The auto industry employs, directly or indirectly, almost 14 million Europeans. There's fear that Beijing will copy the successful solar panel playbook for EVs. According to EU simulations, if the Chinese EV industry were to follow a similar trajectory of subsidies to that applied to the solar panel industry, EU domestic production of EVs would decline by 70%, and EU producers' global market share would fall by 30%. Now, the EU's investigation of Chinese marketing practices has prompted China's Commerce Ministry to warn that China may have to rethink its investments, specifically in Italy, in hopes that Italy will vote against continuing the tariffs. Here's a final note. There is one class of Chinese who are doing just fine during the economic downturn, the super rich. A research organization that tracks these so-called centimillionaires, defined as people with investable wealth of $100 million or more, finds that their number has surged by 54% worldwide over the last decade, with Chinese having the biggest gains. France finally has a prime minister, but few are happy. Thousands of protesters marched across France recently, furious over President Emmanuel Macron's appointment of center-right politician Michel Barnier as prime minister. Leftist parties, led by Jean-Luc Mélenchon's France Unbowed, accused Macron of ignoring this summer's electoral results that left him without a clear majority and called for his resignation. Polls show 74% of French citizens believe Macron has disregarded the election results and 55% feel the election was stolen. Barnier, the 73-year-old former EU Brexit negotiator, faces immediate pressure to form a coalition and fix the failing public health sector. Visiting a Paris hospital, Barnier pledged to make improvements, but said he could not work miracles. His first big test will be the upcoming budget in October, which could trigger a vote of no confidence by both the New Popular Front and the far-right National Rally, whose leader, Jordan Bardella, warned, "Nothing can be done without us." Canada's Prime Minister is in political trouble. A just-concluded special parliamentary election in Montreal resulted in a second straight defeat for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party. These were reliably Liberal Party seats. The pressure to resign from his party is intensifying, but Trudeau insists on carrying on. National elections aren't scheduled until next year. The main opposition party, the Conservatives, has a huge lead in polls right now. Trudeau's popularity hovers around 20%. The high cost of living, a housing shortage, and accusations of being indifferent to foreign interference in Canadian politics by China and India are among the issues that have plagued his administration. An historic drought in Brazil. Climate change and deforestation are bringing an historic drought to Brazil's cities and parts of the countryside. Drought is not new to Brazil, but the scale this time is exceptional. At least 59% of the country has been affected, and more than 1,400 cities. Huge fires, centered in the Amazon region, have caused serious air pollution, as well as destroyed large tracts of forest. An update on Venezuela. Venezuela has arrested 7 people, including 4 Americans, on the charge of seeking to destabilize the Maduro government. The U.S. denies the claim. Maduro's opposition leaders have called on Chevron and other oil companies that do business with Venezuela to cancel their contracts. Chevron is the only U.S.-based company to have received a waiver from the Biden administration to continue working with Venezuela's state-owned oil company. "We want all the oil companies to go to Venezuela, so it's not about the companies," says an opposition statement. "It's about the situation that is impoverishing the country so badly that practically the whole population wants this regime gone." Finally, an update on the Israel-Hamas negotiations. Hamas reportedly has dropped objections to Israel's continued occupation of the Philadelphia Corridor, the strip of land along the Gaza-Egypt border, so long as a timetable is set for Israel's full withdrawal from Gaza and a complete end to the war. That means that during the first stage of an agreement, in which a ceasefire and exchanges of hostages and prisoners take place, Israeli forces could continue to control the corridor. But it is doubtful that Prime Minister Netanyahu will agree, even though that reported concession jibes with his position. To the contrary, he seems inclined to expand the war into Lebanon. Witness, for example, the timed explosion of pagers belonging to Hezbollah fighters, killing several and wounding hundreds of other people. Such a terrorist act can only set back any chance for successful talks on Gaza. Added to that is that Netanyahu is considering firing his defense minister and frequent critic, Yoav Gallant, who has antagonized the ultra-religious factions by opposing a bill to exempt yeshiva students from military service. Firing Gallant would remove one of a few cabinet members who favors a ceasefire and prisoner-hostage exchange. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Laura Grimes, the Executive Director of Oregon Arts Watch. She's here to give us all of the arts updates we crave. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me, Althea. I always love chatting with you.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So we've got a bunch of stories out of Oregon Arts Watch to talk about this week, and I want to start with a story that actually has to do with the law. It's called Warhol and the Supreme Court. Nothing comes from nothing. Now, the Supreme Court has handed down a lot of controversial decisions lately, and this is one that may not have gotten enough attention, but it is really impactful. So for folks who are new to the issue, what's going on in this case?
Yeah, like you mentioned, this is sort of a case that could easily fly under the radar with so much else going on. And I had the same thought as I was reading this story, because it has such a broad impact on the arts community. So David Slater, who is an artist and a retired attorney who lives here in Portland, has written a story about a U.S. Supreme Court decision titled Warhol Foundation versus Goldsmith. And the court ruled that the publication by Condé Nast of one of Warhol's silkscreen prints of the rock musician Prince violated the copyright of the photographer whose photo Warhol had radically transformed. So the new law gives almost no weight to creative contribution, as David writes, and instead, now it's based more on the commercial question of whether the new artwork competes with the original. In fact, is there a financial edge, or who gets the money? It all comes down to money now. And David fascinatingly talks about how not just this work, but you know what this means in the bigger sense for creating art and for artwork, because a lot of art is derivative. And he talks about how art making is an exercise in freedom. And in this ruling, Lynn Goldsmith, who was the original photographer, sued the Warhol Foundation because after Prince died, Condé Nast asked to reprint one of the Warhol prints that had been done some decades earlier. And then when they republished it, Goldsmith sued, saying, no, I had only given rights for one-time use a few decades earlier, and you don't have the right to now use my original photograph again for this Warhol work that was derivative from the photograph. So what happens now is that it takes out the sense of whether or not the artwork has transformed radically enough to alter it so that we've created new artwork. And that's really the crux of it. All artwork is derivative in some ways. We borrow, we steal, we build on ideas. It's a matter of evolution, building ideas. And this now kind of takes the wind out of that sail, and it comes down to this, whether or not they can compete commercially. So it takes out the judgment of artistic merit or artistic change. Has the new artwork changed enough so that it is a brand new work of art? But it can completely have a chilling effect on the act of creating new artwork.
Yeah, I somehow missed this Supreme Court decision from last year, but it really does away with, in some ways, the existing test being fair use and transformation. It really challenges those things by putting it totally in the commercial sphere. I mean, you're the executive director of Oregon Arts Watch. You're working with people who review art, who do art in our community. How much of that, you know, sole focus on the commercial aspect, like how do you expect that to impact artists?
Yeah, it's a good question because it's such a fairly new ruling. You know, we've only had a few months to sit with it. So I think there's a lot that will still shake out about it. But it does turn our existing copyright laws on its head. The United States Copyright Act of 1976 sort of, you know, had a way to measure fair use, as it was called, and now that puts us more on uncertain ground. What does qualify as fair use? Is it changed enough? Is it transformed enough? No, if it comes down to now whether artworks will compete with the original commercially, that changes the equation. And it takes the value of creative process, creative art, out of the equation now, so that basically judges don't want to have to deal with messiness. You know, how do you qualify something, and if their equation is not as complicated that they can say, oh, it's just based on money, it makes it easier for the law. But artwork doesn't work that way. It's all about creativity and artistic value. So I think we'll still figure out how all of that plays out, but David will explore more of this. This first story was part one. And he will have two more stories. One that will talk about how a lot of art is derivative. We borrow from history, we build on history. And then his third part will talk with Oregon artists and about how this will affect their work. So I'm going to be really fascinated to read that. I think he's waiting for some feedback. We'll talk to people, and then we'll see how the artistic community responds to this.
Well, pivoting here to another story from Oregon Arts Watch, or should I say a couple of stories, because you guys have been covering the TBA Festival in Portland. What's the latest?
Yes, so we have, I believe, four stories now, and I think a couple more are planned. And TBA will run through September 22nd. So two of our latest stories, one is by Ella Ray, Video Tones, Outside Inside World. This is an exhibition that is co-presented by PICA, which puts on the TBA Festival, and the Pacific Northwest College of Art. So this is an exhibit that is at PNCA. And what I find really interesting about this is that it is produced by a digital media collective. It's a collaborative work that is mostly digital based. I think there are sculptures and events, but it runs through all of TBA and it changes constantly, so that you could even view this artwork several times and it will always be different. And it, because it's done by a collaborative group, there is no single ownership. And the fact that it changes all the time, it means that there's no sense of permanence or finality to it. So it's an interesting concept, and the digital media collective includes artists who are intellectually and developmentally disabled, their caregivers, and their community members. So I'm actually very fascinated by that experimental work that is always changing. So the second TBA story we have is about Force, an opera that has already been performed. But I think the story is terrific in that it discusses the ripple effects of incarceration. And the story is by Lucy Cotter. And what I think it just does a really good job of talking about the entire community of incarcerated people. It is set in the pre-visitation room of a prison, which I think is a really interesting device because it's this limbo space. You're not entirely in the free world and you're not entirely in prison. You're in this in-between space that is limbo. And these are the people who are there to visit their loved ones who are in prison. So it's the community in that space. And what I liked about this review is that it talks about how the performance really affected the audience. And there was a sense of having a psychological and physical effect on people. It sort of, you had to stay in this space, you had to be guided, you had to give up your personal rights and your sense of freedom in a way. So it affected the audience, and it talked about, you know, this limbo space in how people who are incarcerated affects all of the community around them. It affects their loved ones in this way. They lose their own, not just sense of space, but their own sense of time. They are in this limbo space for the entire time that their loved one is in prison. And it's a important topic because people of color are incarcerated 6 times more than the rate of white people.
So that's what's going on in the Time-Based Art Festival, which runs through the 22nd, is that right?
Yes, correct. Yep, and we'll have a couple more stories about TBA as well.
Nice. Well, looking ahead, the Portland Book Festival is coming up, and the group Literary Arts is also opening their new building. What should listeners be looking out for in this festival?
Oh, yeah. So I'm first going to talk about how they have this new headquarters. We have a brand new story posted by Brian Libby. This is a big deal. Literary Arts is moving from their longtime space in downtown Portland to the central east side, local east side. And they are celebrating their 40th anniversary this year. It means a substantial move forward. Literary Arts is a big deal in Portland. We're a big book town, and I think that the support for literary arts and how they have grown and expanded really is a testament to that.
If our listeners are interested in reading more of these stories that we talked about today, or any of the stuff that is published through Oregon Arts Watch, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can read all of these at Oregon Arts Watch, which is orartswatch.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Oh, we have a couple of other good stories. We have a really nice story about Abigail Scott Duniway's first book that she ever wrote. So whenever we can talk about this powerhouse for women's rights, that's always nice too. So I highly recommend that story by Richard Edelaine as well.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Yeah, I always love talking with you, Althea. Thanks so much.
That was Laura Grimes, the executive director of Oregon Arts Watch, speaking with me about some of the recent coverage from her publication. More information at orartswatch.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.